Hey, this is Steve Balton. You are here on People Have the Power, where this week, really fun and interesting conversation, as it always is, with the great Wayne Coyne of The Flaming Lips. Such a fun talk about everything from plastic bubble shows, of course, to Black Sabbath, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, politics, and much more. Hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did with Wayne.
I mean, look, there are certain things that you definitely miss from being in the same room with someone. But for business calls, interviews, yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, are you kidding? I mean, I think the benefits of doing, like even you and I doing it this way, I think that it's just so much easier and so much faster, and we're just doing it. We're not spending time driving, parking. There's no, when you're face-to-face with people, there is a certain amount of, you know, just chit-chat. Hey, how you doing? Good to be here. Hey, man, good to see you. You know, that's 40% of your time. And then you say, oh, what are we here to talk about? Whereas I sort of feel like doing it this way, it's like, okay, yeah, what are you talking about? Here we go. And we're just sitting in our house, you know? It's like, yeah, we're doing our thing. There's no socialness about it, you know? We're just sitting in our underwear in our house.
Well, what's weird about that, though, is the reality is, as you well know, people are already getting more socially incompetent to begin with. So anything that creates a situation where people can be less social is not a benefit, you know?
Well, I mean,
that is one issue.
I don't know if that was ever going to be fixed, you know? I mean, I think no one really knows the real reason why people go to concerts, you know? A lot of times people will, you know, they pretend like they're going because they like music and they want to see a band. And oftentimes they just go and they don't really know that the band is playing or not. You know, it's, you know, that's kind of what concerts have sort of become. You know, since Woodstock, you know, happened, it's sort of like no one wants to miss out on the great cool thing that happened. You know, what was it? It's the Fyre Festival.
Yeah.
You know, it's not music people. It's not artists. It's like, what is that? You know, so maybe that needed a little bit of a break anyway. You know, that was starting to turn me off of, you know, I would go to Bonnaroos and Coachellas and all that when we weren't playing, but less and less I didn't like it as much because you're kind of just assailed by that kind of social, you know, I want to be seen at a cool thing. Is this cool? Am I in a cool place? It's like, you know, so yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I'm not glad that the coronavirus is making people sick or making people lose their jobs or any of that. But there are things that I feel like, oh, good, this is going to change and maybe change forever.
Well, it's funny. I was going to say, you know, and what you're talking about is when people go to be, that's where I always end up arguing with people is because you get the people who are there who never shut the fuck up to actually listen to the music.
Well, see, you're more blunt than I am, but yeah, you're exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. That's why the coronavirus is so easily spread at a concert because people want to yell in your fucking face instead of listening to a group. Yeah, exactly. They're screaming right here because the music's loud and the corona is getting in your eye and in your nose and your mouth. Yeah, exactly.
Didn't you guys do though like a one-off like plastic bubble show where everyone was in bubbles? Everyone?
Well, we did, you know, with the help of the Stephen Colbert show, you know, they contacted me right at the beginning of the pandemic, which is now going on forever, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I had made this little cartoon where, you know, it had the two panels where in 2019, I'm the only one in a space bubble. And in 2020, everybody's in a space bubble, me and the audience and everybody in the band. Making a, you know, it's funny, you know. And when they got a hold of me about doing one of these, of course, now it's from home shows, which is pretty normal now. But at the time, it was sort of like, I think we're going to be doing these things where you just do something and you send it to us. And I said, well, I want to do this space bubble, you know, cartoon like I made here. And the guy that I was talking to is like, yeah, we do too. We want to see if you can do that. And this is right at the beginning of the whole thing, and everything shut down. So, you know, we're getting these bubbles. We're getting them from China, you know, the epicenter of don't touch anything there. And they set right to it. And 3 weeks later, we started to receive all these, you know, these different space bubbles from different parts of China and all that. We ended up having 26 of them. And I did it all thinking by time we actually do it on the air, course this is going to be over and it's going to be funny. You know, it's entertainment, you know. But as we know, it may not ever end now, you know. I mean, so, you know, at the time it was funny, and at the time it was bizarre, but it was real. I mean, we did it in a time in Oklahoma City where we all thought that the coronavirus was at its lowest spot. But about a month after that, it got a lot worse. And so, you know, we took a lot of effort to make it, you know, as safe as we could. And it really didn't end up being safe compared to just drunk people screaming in each other's faces. So in that way, I think it was utterly successful. And I think it looks cool, and it looks, you know, it's an amazing sort of thing to behold, you know, but it really does work. And I think of all the people in the world, I mean, we've probably messed with these space bubbles at a concert. I would say probably more than anybody, you know. We've been doing it since 2004. And as ridiculous as that sounds, yeah, we kind of have a lot of firsthand experience on how it could work, how it couldn't, what's good and what's bad about it. Yeah. How much air is in those things and everything. Yeah.
All right. So will we see like a full show with one of those, or a full show with those forever? Because like you say, though, but they're not easy to get for people. It's funny because, you know, there's been a lot of talk if there was a socially distant show in England this week, the first one where they had everyone on these like metal stages and stuff.
But
it just is, I mean, you know, it's funny. You go back to like what happened with the Chainsmokers in the Hamptons, and it's like, you know, you can't personally blame them. I'm not necessarily the hugest fan, but I mean, it's not their fault that a bunch of fucking douchebags from the Hamptons decided, oh, cool, we don't need to stay in the cars and we're going to run up to the front, you know, and ruin drive-in concerts for everyone.
Well, I agree. I mean, that's the risk everybody takes. I mean, no one knows the names of the people that did it. They just know the Chainsmokers were the people that kept playing while it was happening. And I agree. I don't think it's anybody's fault. And I don't even think it's the audience's fault. I think you could easily say, well, you know, I'm just here with my friends and I don't have it and they don't have it. And who gives a fuck? But once it gets into the news and gets into the papers and all that, you know, all rational thinking goes out and it starts becoming... And, you know, and the truth is, if you get one person sick and they die from it, that's just not worth it, you know. So I think in our way, you know, all this has happened so, you know, time has sort of stopped, you know. The way the Flaming Lips would be working, you know, previous to this would be just going a mile a minute, you know. It'd just be chaos. So, you know, some of this is just, it's given us a lot of time to think about, well, how would we do this? You know, how do we clean these space bubbles in between? Like, let's say we did a show on Tuesday night and then we want to do another show, say, you know, somewhere else on Thursday night. Well, the coronavirus or whatever it is inside those space bubbles where those people, because you can put like three people into a bubble. And we thought, well, how do you clean them? Well, we got big solution of the 90 proof stuff, poured it in there, blew it up, rolled it around, and man, you know, it almost killed us. You know, so so, you know, there's a lot of practical things about it that you go, well, you know, I know it seems like it's kind of like a joke, like a Jetsons kind of joke, but part of it is kind of real because you do fear the Chainsmokers thing. It's like, though I'm being careful, the douchebag right next to me is drunk and he wants to scream in my face. And it really only takes a couple of minutes. I mean, we were at a wedding in Montana just last weekend where the same thing happened. And luckily we were outside and I was able to just be like, I'm going to leave, you know. But, you know, if that got our, you know, our baby's grandmother, if she got sick from that, I mean, you know, you don't want to take that risk. And the risk isn't just yours. You know, you're kind of at the mercy of these other people. So, this way that we're doing it, I'm not saying we're doing it because I'm just doing it because this is the way the Flaming Lips do stuff. I would imagine there's 100 people coming up with a solution that's going to work, you know. But and I think those stages we saw, I don't know where it was, somewhere in Europe, you know, where it's a big field and there's a bunch of stages. You know, for me personally, I wouldn't care. If there was a band I wanted to see and I had time to go, I would go. I mean, I don't really care that much. You know, I don't really care about all that. I like seeing bands play and I like listening to music. So I wouldn't really care if it's in a it's in a bubble, if it's on a stage somewhere, but I certainly wouldn't risk being next to some drunk Yahoo that's going to, you know, breathe his virus on me.
Yeah. No, it's interesting, you know, but it's funny because you say it's not anybody's fault. But like you going back to the you know, that Chainsmoker show, and again, it's not their fault, you know, like, but it is, even if you don't have it and your friends don't have it, or you think you don't have it and your friends don't have it, you have no idea what the hell anybody else has. Well,
yeah.
You know, I mean, so it's just, that's the issue.
Because you're a smart, caring human that knows you're inhabiting this planet with a bunch of other humans. I mean, I just think it's the way that, especially being president, I think that's just the way it's gone. It's not about being president. It's a show. And once things become a show, it's like the O.J. Simpson trial. It's like all these things. Logic goes out the window and suddenly it becomes the most stupidest thing that could happen is what people are going to read about tomorrow. Not the smartest thing, not the most thought out thing. It's the stupidest thing. So yeah, I mean, becoming president has become a show, and you know, you can't, I have to say, you know, you can't turn away from it. You know, there was a time when I could, I didn't really care what Trump said or anything. It just didn't affect me. And then this happened, you know, you can't quite believe.
Well, I mean, yeah, he literally is just saying right out in the open, oh, cool, I'm going to destroy the post office so no one could actually, you know, work. Never mind the fact that old people, you know, need their drugs. Never mind the fact that people, you know, are getting paid, you know, waiting on checks, waiting on the fact that, you know, people aren't going to get paid, that postal workers are going to lose their jobs. He's like, no, because I'm not going to win a fair election. I know this. So this is my only solution, you know? I mean, and he's just saying it out in the open, not even trying to pretend.
Well, I think he'll say anything that people will, you know, make a headline out of, and he doesn't care. I mean, he'll say one thing one day, and he'll say exactly the opposite the next day, and he'll say, but you said this, and he'll be like, well, I changed my mind, I was wrong. You know, and that's just the way it is. We don't really need to hear that sort of news every 5 minutes, you know. Used to be you could catch up on all the news, you know, one day a week, and that was plenty. You could go back to your life, but now it's like every 5 minutes, you need to know what he said because it's the stupidest, you know, stupidest thing ever. And it's, you know, you can't turn away. You know, you really can't turn away. And so I don't know. We kind of, you know, it's our fault. It's our fault that we care what he says. It's our fault that we pay attention, because really he's just going to say whatever is going to get him attention. And what he actually does and what he can actually do, who fucking knows? But, you know, He's not known for doing much other than, talking about himself.
Yeah, it's such an interesting thing. And what's interesting is we've done about 20 something of these now, probably about 25, and it's amazing how few songs have been repeated. There are certain ones like "A Public Enemy," "Fight the Power," Bob Marley, that have come up quite a bit. Take me through the couple that you picked. And, you know, it's a really interesting thing, because what I thought about specifically with you before we come on to your first choice is, you know, I'm sure you've known Matt from The National for a while now, or you guys have played some shows together or come into contact with him, correct?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know them all that well, but we've definitely played plenty of shows and been around each other, yeah.
Great, dude. And it's something he said to me really resonated, and I'd be curious to get your thoughts on it now, you know, is that he spoke about... We talked about mixing, and this was a couple of years ago, we talked about mixing, you know, politics and music together. And he talked about the fact that for him now, being a father, everything was political in some respect because of how he saw the world. And, you know, obviously, this is the first record you guys have made since you have had become a father. And what's interesting about it, by the way, too, is absolutely fucking mind-blowingly beautiful record. It's interesting because it actually is probably the opposite.
Thank you for saying that. I mean, you know, that when, you know, you get used to making records, but it always is great to hear, you know, people who do music is a high altar for everybody, you know, so thank you for saying that.
Oh, it's absolutely gorgeous. And it's interesting because it's probably, given the times and everything that we're living in, it's different than I would have expected, in the sense of it's so lush and orchestral and beautiful and sort of like this really, it becomes this great escape from, you know, the shit that we were just talking about.
Well, I mean, I think part of having a child, you know, there's probably, I don't know what the percentage is, but, you know, in every human, there's a desire, some sort of instinctual desire to nurture, you know, and when we read about or hear about people that don't have this desire, you know, you go, what the fuck is wrong with you, you know? So I think, you know, I come from a big sort of Irish Catholic family. All my older brothers had crazy fucking friends, drugs, motorcycles, just crazy, crazy shit all the time, you know? And when I turned 21, 22, you know, I form the Flaming Lips, which is another family, you know, in a sense. I didn't think of it at the time. But, so I think for the longest time, I'm nurturing the Flaming Lips. They're my family, you know, everybody involved with it, everybody that works with the Flaming Lips. And so I think for the longest time, I did have that as my family. And I probably did have an underlying nurturing desire. And so by the time I got our real child came into the world, I think I finally was like, oh, good. All right. Now I have a real thing that needs my nurturing and wants my nurturing and is going to be helped by my nurturing. Whereas probably the guys in the band probably secretly said, Wayne, we can take care of ourselves. We don't really, need you worrying about us all the time. So that probably helped me a lot too, you know, and probably helped me just balance out just what's important, how important music is, how important art is, and how important, you know, being healthy and happy and all that is, which is way more important. I mean, you know, sometimes people want to put music on a pedestal like, man, without music, I would die. And I'm like, no, you'd be fine. You'd be fine. We're seeing that in this pandemic, you know, all essential workers, you know, go to work. You know who's not working? Musicians. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not essential. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. And you don't need to go to work. I think we've made music so music can be with you anyway. You don't need to go to a concert. I mean, some of my greatest musical experiences aren't at concerts. They're just with a song in my life, you know, just listening to it and relating to it or whatever. So I don't know. You know, I probably wouldn't be the one to really know what effect it has, because a lot of those effects, you know, they're kind of beneath your consciousness. You know, they're part of you. They're so much a part of you, you wouldn't recognize it as part of you, you know. So I'm sure it's had an effect. I hope it's had a great effect. And I hope it's let me be a little bit more just letting it all, just not holding back. You know, I've seen that happen more and more with the Flaming Lips. It's like, you know, when you're talking about death and you're talking about family and you're talking about, you know, friends and drugs and all that sort of stuff. I want to hear the truth. I think it's such a luxury when you talk to someone who doesn't exaggerate and doesn't, you know, want to sound cool. Someone who will just tell you, this is the truth the way it happened to me. So I always feel like that's important for me to do. I don't know if what I'm saying is going to be cool or if I'm going to look like an idiot or whatever. But I think that's one of the things that music does. Music holds you there and says, whatever you say, it's going to be all right, because music is loving you and the music lets you say these things. And it's, you know, it lets you be vulnerable and fragile. And especially this type of music, this American Head album. And, you know, some of it's so gentle and emotional that it's letting you, you know, it's letting you say things. So that part I really, really love about it, you know, that we didn't turn a corner and try to be smart or cool or clever or whatever.
All right, so now let me ask you, by the way, as well, because since you're talking about music that tells you the truth, we're going to steer it back to the protest songs for a minute.
Yeah.
Because, you know, great protest songs definitely tell the truth, you know. So what's one for you that...
Well, you know, I've thought, and I do think it's true. You know, I don't think music at its best, I don't think it can stand a chance at stopping wars. I think people wrongly think, you know, that... you know, the Beatles or someone, you know, in the late 60s stopped the Vietnam War. And the Vietnam War didn't really end until like 1975, you know. And by the time it ended, no one really cared, you know. No one was really singing about the war ending when it actually ended, you know. One of the greatest, yeah, I don't even know if it's a protest song. It seems like it's a reaction. It's, you know, the Tin Soldiers, Nixon's Coming, you know, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young song, you know. But is that a protest song, or is that just you know, maybe it's a warning for the future, you know. I love it as a song, and I would sing it even without it having any meaning of, oh, we don't like, you know, we don't like the president, and we don't like this sort of aggressive stuff that's happening, and we don't like the police being aggressive towards peaceful protesters or whatever. It seems more appropriate even now than ever, but I've really hardly heard it. So that's, but is that a protest song, or is that just me sort of appointing it a protest song?
Oh, no, that's actually considered one of the definitive protest songs of all time, Ohio. But it's interesting because coming up, talking with intelligent people in this show, one of the things that's been interesting and I've enjoyed is, right, I spoke with Carlos and Cindy Santana. And, yeah. Wow. You know, they brought up a point about, you know, there are songs that are, protest songs that have a wide range of, meaning there are songs that are kind of healing. Like a Dylan, for example, some of the softer, earlier Dylan stuff, which sort of feels like a more healing thing, you know, like a blowing in the wind or at times they are changing. Then you have songs that get you fired up, like Cindy mentioned James Brown, I'm Black and I'm Proud. You know, so protest songs, there's a wide range of things. And again, you have, you know, I mean, you have Rage Against the Machine is protest music. You have The Clash made protest music, but you also have Joni Mitchell made protest, you know, so I mean, it does cover such a wide range of things. So the idea of protest, you know, it really is much wider, I think, than people think. It's not just the idea anymore of, you know, people with a guitar sitting in a field playing to, you know.
Right. Yeah. I mean, but, you know, for me, the bottom line really always is you got to kind of like the song, you know, and thankfully, a lot of these songs that have been deemed protest songs, they're fucking great songs anyway. You just are waiting for an excuse to go out and sort of sing them. So, you know, Ohio would be one of those. It's sort of like virtually anytime something would happen, you got this great thing that sort of helps. It, you know, they're really made to help you express it because you don't know what to say. And a song gives you all this freedom and all this rhythm and all this stuff. And you can be the person in the song screaming this stuff. My second one would be Black Sabbath, War Pigs, which...
Oh, that's a great one.
I mean, we started to do it, I mean, in a silly way. We're not pretending to ever be playing to an audience that would be protesting or would think of it as a protest song right after George W. Bush won the second time, you know. We started to play it, and I think it just made everybody feel like, oh, good. We're acknowledging this. You know, we're in this thing. And sometimes you don't have a place to put your frustration and anger. And sometimes it is well placed to be in a song. And you get to scream it, and you get to talk about it, and you get to be there with other people screaming it. And sometimes that's good. You know, we don't really want to approach everything with our head full of aggression, uninformed aggression, and beat our way into it. You know, I think it's great that music can kind of be this, you know, this thing that lets out some of the steam so you can decide with a cooler head and, you know, that, what do I do about this? Because, I mean, that really is the dilemma afterwards. After the song ends, any of them, you go, well, what do I do? Because listening to a song isn't anything. You know, listening to a song is just fun. You know, it's supposed to be the motivator, but a lot of times the song is all there is, and people don't go out and change anything or do anything or figure anything out. They just like the song, which I don't blame them because nobody knows what to do. But I have to say during this last couple of months with the Black Lives Matter, you know, protests and all that, I thought it was fucking amazing. I really did. I wasn't glad that they got violent or any of that, but I just thought it was amazing that it could really hold the attention of everybody for as long as it did. And for people to truly make an effort to be like, I'm involved and I'm standing with you. I'm here with you. And the protests that happened here in Oklahoma City, they happened on some fucking hot, hot summer days. It's people, I didn't go because I feared, you know, there'd be a bunch of dumbasses out there with guns and, you know, it only takes a stray bullet going to the wrong place one time and you're, you know, your little boy, you know, or your wife or you get a bullet in the head, you know. So I didn't want to go because I felt like if it got dangerous, I'd be putting everybody at too much of a risk. But I mean, they were out there for 8-9 hours on some blistering Oklahoma summer days. And it was like, man, hats off to you, you know. And a lot of the police here were really patient and really cool and really understanding. And so, I thought some of it was like, wow, this really happened, you know. And I think some things will change over it. I think some minds have changed over it. But a lot of that stuff takes a long, long time. You know, you gotta stick with it. You gotta really keep working at it, you know. But the song, you know, is, I guess, can be there to remind you of that surge, that energy, that anger, that reason, you know. What would be some other ones that I know I like just because they're cool songs that, yeah. I mean, you know, I do like some of the Dylan ones, but I just, I think they kind of get brought out just too often.
What's interesting, though, is that they haven't been brought out as much in this show as I expected. Actually, the artists who have been mentioned the most, and I think it's probably because the show started during Black Lives Matter, have been Bob Marley, and yep. Surprisingly, and in a good way, Nina Simone.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, there's that, there is that footage of her. What's the song she's doing?
Is it the Goddamn Mississippi one?
That one, but I forget there's one where, I've probably listened to it 1,000 times, but I don't know the title, but where... Oh, I'll have to look at it. Yeah, I have to look at it. But even with her, I mean, for me personally, I mean, I get so, you know, sort of hypnotized by her that I don't care what she's singing about. That's always, you know, it's so powerful, you know. And so I forget. Oh yeah, those are protest songs. I'm sorry. I was just listening because I like the way you sound and the way you play. So I would agree. I would include her, but I would forget to, you know. So I'm just trying to think of like what are some that I thought sounded like protest songs when my older brothers you know really did go and protest Vietnam War and stuff. There's a song. And luckily, you can Google this song. It's called "Things Get a Little Easier Once You Understand." I forget the name of the group. You'll like it though when you find out who it is.
So I'm gonna go to the computer right now.
Yeah, things get a little easier once you understand. And when you hear it, you're gonna think it's the group. What's the group that was in that does? Sugar, dun, 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 dun.
The Archies.
Archies. It sounds like them, but it's not them. That's how good it is, you know. That's how hokey it is. So things get a little easier once you understand.
Well, let me see. That can't be, no. It has to be an original version that I cannot find.
We found it a couple times. I know it's out there.
Think. Well, no, it's funny. It was a band called Think,
yeah,
put together by producers in 1971. And it's funny, the only reason I said it had to be earlier was because the first version that you look up when you find it is Biz Markie. And I was like, nope, it wasn't Biz Markie.
Exactly.
We did the Vietnam War.
Yeah, we did the same thing, yeah. So, you know, this is kind of like the kid is sort of following he's protesting and he's growing his hair long. And his mom and dad don't approve, and they're fighting, and at the very end of the song, a police officer comes to the door, you know, knocks on the door and says, "You have a son," and they found him dead, and he dies of a drug overdose, you know, and it's a horribly sad, hokey piece of music, you know. But I remember this being like a song that we had listened to as a kind of, yeah, you know, society needs to change. This is a sign of this, and it's in a song that's popular on the radio. So that would be one that I would to me seems like a protest song. No one else is going to pick that, and it's a great song.
No, I've never even heard that one.
Once you hear it, you're going to go, "Why haven't I heard this 1,000 times?" So another one that I would say protest song. What's that song by? Three Dog Night. It's from the Hair musical. Why do people have no feelings?
Why? Easy to be hard.
Yeah. You know, I mean, to me, these songs were kind of put into this format of like, these are going against, you know, the old way. These are going against the way that people think you're to be a man or to be successful or to be smart, you know, and to be gentle and to be forgiving, you know. So, you know, to me, those were always the songs that I thought were, you know, the revolution, the change was in you. It wasn't, I mean, I still don't really give a fuck about changing who's president. I don't really care. That doesn't really affect me that much. You know, to me, it's like my family and my neighborhood, you know, it affects me more than anything that any president has ever done. So I think I veer towards those songs that are, you know, they're about changing humankind. They're not about changing some policy, you know.
Well, but it's so interesting because, I mean, obviously in this instance, I think, and it's funny because Adam and I were talking about this earlier, and I think, you know, I agree with you, but I think in this instance, obviously it is different because changing this president is about changing humankind. Because, you know, so I think it's taken on an added intent. I agree with you typically, but I mean, obviously we're living in such different times.
It depends. See, I think if you give him that much power, you're giving him more power than he deserves. I mean, I don't even like to talk about this, but it's true. You know, the day Donald Trump was elected president, the marijuana laws and the drinking laws in Oklahoma, the very next day were like relaxed. 2 years later, marijuana became legal in Oklahoma. It has nothing to do with Trump. I know that. But I'm just saying for my own life, if I was to say who was president and what got better, I would say living in Oklahoma, the reddest fucking, you know, the most Trump state there probably is, these things really changed. And it has nothing to do with Trump. And I'd say, you know, I've never waited for no fucking president to tell me how to live. I'm not looking to them for any leadership on what to do. I don't care what they think, you know. So for me, Trump is just another, like, I don't care, you know. I mean, I vote for my local guys because I know them and I know if I need some help and I know the ways that they can help me, that's what I'm looking for. Of course, I'm going to vote for president. I hope all that works out. But to me, it's more important who's your guy in your neighborhood that's going to help you than who's the guy in Washington that's, you know, the face of all this, you know. So that would be my weirdo take on it, you know. But I don't want people to think you shouldn't vote, you shouldn't be involved. I think in a funny way, because Trump is so atrocious, we've all gotten more involved. You know what I mean? We all,
yeah,
you know, we all care about this stuff that's happening at the border. I have to say, when Obama was president, I literally said, you got this. You don't need me. I'm gonna go make money and have fun. See ya, you know. And I think we let him down. I mean, I think when he was elected, we stood right there with him and said, "Man, this we knew this was coming, and you're the guy." But when he got elected for the second time, I think we all were like, "You got this, brother. See you later." You know, I'm gonna go party for a while, and yeah, you know, we helped Trump, you know, get in there in a way, because we kind of stopped fighting. You know, the minute you stop fighting, they start winning. That's just the truth. But who wants to fucking fight all the time, you know? So are you finding it? You'll find it. If you don't find it, I can find it and send it to you.
No, I found the songs, the Three Dog Night one.
Yep.
And Think the Band.
Yeah. Do you want to listen to it a second? You'll see what I'm saying.
No, I'll check it out in a bit, but okay. It's funny because there's so many different directions I want to go in. And it's one of the things that I enjoy about this, and it's always been interesting, right, is as you look at these songs, right, and you think about these songs, whether it's a Black Sabbath or a Think,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's, I mean, to then talk about how it ties in or works into your own work. And do you see, you know, do you see it through, and it's interesting because Flaming Lips, it's funny because as you're talking about this, it makes sense. Because I don't think of Flaming Lips as being protest music, but it is very humanistic music. And this is a very humanistic album.
Oh, there you go. Well, I would say, you know, if you really want people to listen to you and you really want to change their minds, you know, the last thing you want to do is go screaming at them and telling them they're stupid and that you're right and they're wrong, you know? So for me, I think gentle music that understands that people, you know, have trouble understanding each other, that really is kind of that's the way to change the world. That's the way to help the world. That's the way to, you know, but those songs aren't often as fun to sing, like something like the Beatles Revolution or something, you know, that shit just fucking sounds good to get jacked up on, you know? What was some of the Clash music? I mean, some of the Clash's stuff, you know, some of it's so British. I don't really know what they're bitching about, but I definitely love singing along with it, you know? But one of theirs that I always like, and I don't know who did it originally. It's a reggae. It's got to be a reggae cover of Armageddon Time.
Okay.
And you know, I heard it through them. I had never even heard the person who really did it. I've heard it through them, but you know, I mean, when the Clash does. And I don't really go to reggae music that often, you know, but when the Clash did it, I mean, it was just hypnotic, but not hippie. And I'm a hippie myself. I love hippies. I love freaks, you know, but there was something about a lot of reggae music was just, you know, don't worry, be happy, which I love that song too. I mean, what a fucking insane thing to say. Which is true. People hate that song, but I love that song. You know, I wouldn't say it's a protest song, but I love it that it's so amazingly true and simple, you know.
Armageddon Time, by the way, was by a guy by the name of Willie Williams.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, yeah. That's cool. Yeah. But I mean, when the Clash did it, I mean, to me, I always sort of felt like that was, you know, a great new psychedelic, expansive, you know, slightly mind altering, revolutionary protests, you know, something's going on there. So, but you know, a lot of things they would sing about, I wouldn't really know what the situation was, you know, white riot, I want to riot, white riot, I'll riot on my own. You know, I'm like, I like the songs, but I wouldn't always know what it was, you know?
So it's interesting. Is there, when you think of those artists then though, who were very humanistic, you know, I want to tie it in with the new albums. It's such a wonderful record.
Yeah, I would say, you know, and I'm sure people have mentioned Marvin Gaye, you know, that string of songs that he has. And those are, you know, those are later in the 70s. You know, they're not in the very radical, turbulent 60s, you know, but, you know, those couple of songs that he has, mother, mother, there's no, you know, those.
Yeah.
Because they're so gentle and so understanding, I think you do listen. You know, and you say, oh, okay, you know, so maybe that's my version of it. You know, in the long run, I think you do get a great jolt out of those, you know, Rage Against the Machine type things. But a lot of times you don't know what to do afterwards, whereas, you know, these gentle songs about being, you know, being forgiving and being kind and being understanding, that probably is more my vibe and more my answer to things.
Cool. We'll make these last two questions.
Okay.
One, you know, so when you go back and hear, you know, American Head,
yeah,
and you know, think about doing this record live too, because eventually at some point you will be able to do it live.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Whether it's with everybody in plastic bubbles or not.
Yeah.
It is such a beautiful orchestral record. I mean, are there things that you are particularly excited to bring to the stage?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, all that sort of stuff. I mean, we've been doing that since, you know, the late 90s, trying to sort of, you know, get the hugeness of orchestras and all that power, you know. And I mean, some of these songs, I just think having an audience in front of you with those types of, they're just, how do we say it? They're just easy to get caught up in. You know, they have almost every song has like a long drum fill letting you know we're coming to a beat. You know, it's just real, it's real easy to get caught up in it, you know. And I even think the song that came out today, the Will You Return, I mean, we were already at the very last sound check that we did in Mexico. Steven was doing a little bit of it and it stopped everybody. He was just doing a little bit on his own because we had just come up with the song. And it was at a weird sound check where it was in the middle of the night and people were tired and it was kind of, everybody was miserable. And he started to do this. And I saw the whole place you know, kind of like, what is that? Man, that's great. I did the same thing. I was trying to make my way out to the front of house, and he started to do it. And I was like, oh man, that just, man, there's something about that. So yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's always, we're glad that there's a lot of our songs that people look forward to hearing, but there's always new songs that, you know, you look forward to playing just because you want to get that connection. So yeah, and these types of songs, they're fun to play at big concerts. You know, they're things that you get to feel. It's not anger and aggression and all that. It's just, oh, you know, you get to feel the love.
Well, it's got a beauty that you get to feel.
Yeah. I mean, music has that. You know, there's not very many things that have it in that capacity where it's like, you know, it's coming and it's a surprise at the same time. It's, to Steve and I, we talk about it like tickling. We say it's like tickling, you know, like if you tickle yourself, it doesn't work. You know, it's not, but if someone else does it, it works, you know. And that's what we think music can do. Music gets to do that because you know it's coming. You know exactly what it is, but it's still a surprise. I don't know what it is, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, and the last question, I'm doing this Forbes piece. This is like a bonus question, but it's funny because I don't know if you agree with me or not. But, you know, 75, I have now decided that I'm making the contention that 1975 is the greatest year ever for album rock. That's my choice for the best year ever for album rock, with Blood on the Tracks, Born to Run, Horses, Physical Graffiti, Roxy Music Siren, A Night at the Opera. Like, it's just the quality of everything. So do you have a favorite album from that year? And is there like a memory that you have of music from that year?
Well, I mean, I'm not as versed as exactly what year records come out. You said, did you say Physical Graffiti?
Yep. 6 weeks at number one in 1975.
I mean, when that record came out, that would be one of the Led Zeppelin records that, you know, previous to that, I would have had Led Zeppelin records, but I wouldn't have had it when it first came out. That was the first Led Zeppelin record that I got when it came out. And man, yeah. I mean, I remember that. It's such a, some of it is so cool sounding. I mean, you know, no group sounded that fucking great, you know, for it to be a weird double record. And, you know, some of it I don't care about that much, but some of it, I mean, to me, like Kashmir, I mean, that's just such an insane, such a great sounding song, such a great song, such a mystical fucking trip, you know? So yeah, I mean, I wasn't really even aware what year it came out, but that'd be hard to argue with you on that level. You're saying Queen, the Bohemian Rhapsody record?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Neil Young, Tonight's the Night came out that year.
I mean, that's just because we're old, you know. You know.
There has to be, one year has to have been the best year ever for album rock. And I'm maintaining that it's set where you had, you know, Born to Run was such a landmark album.
I would have known it was somewhere around there, but I wouldn't have known it was 1975. Okay.
Well, that's, you know, that's what you, when you're a music geek, those are the things you think about, you know?
Well, but I think, you know, there is something to be said when, you know, when what music is being made is influencing the music that's going to be made, you know, and I could see, you know, when Dylan was at his peak, people like the Beatles were like, fuck, he's doing shit I want to do, you know? And so everybody is upping the ante, you know? So when things are going good, it, especially in music and art, you know, it pushes it to being like, well, maybe it can go this far. And even for a song like Bohemian Rhapsody, I remember hearing that the first time on the radio, but to think that it could be on the radio, I mean, that's insane. And so by the time I'm hearing it on the radio, someone's already thinking it's a fucking hit. And I'm hearing it like, this is, I mean, I wanted to hear it 100 more times. You know, you just go out immediately and get the album. And still, even by today's standards, anybody's standards, it's just a fucking insane fucking song. And it's one of the biggest hits ever. So it, you know, it just goes against what people think about music. It's like, oh, you know, music that reaches the masses has to be stupid and dumbed down or whatever. And it's like, no, it just has to reach the masses. Sometimes it can be the fucking freakiest thing ever, but if it, you know, if you hear it and you like it, yeah, that's all it takes, you know? And I think Queen were ready to be, I mean, that whole record is good. It's not just that song, you know, it's a good record, you know? So yeah, okay. I would, without having too many real dates set in my mind, I'd say, okay, I agree with you.
Yeah. Cool. Anything that you want to add I did not ask you about, just because I know you want to get back to, you know,
yeah.
Family life.
No, I mean, I don't care. And what you said about our album and it, I mean, that's already plenty for me. Cause I totally understand what you're saying. You know, I totally get it. And I think sometimes we as the Flaming Lips, I mean, we're so lucky that we get to kind of really, really make records, you know. I mean, we spend years making records. And so this record, you know, started 2 or 3 years ago, and we'd find a little song, we'd say, man, that song sounds good with this song, that sounds good with that. And you hope you get like 5 or 6 of them rolling along. And when we did, we thought, man, I think we might have something here. Yeah, I know. So I'm glad that you feel the same way. I mean, we do a lot of records, you know, we do a lot of weird shit, and we know it's very difficult to keep up with us. It's difficult for us to keep up, you know? But I think making all of our records allows us to really sometimes, man, sometimes you can really hone in on the thing that can crack that emotional moment, you know? And I think that's, when that's happened on this record, we thank the gods of music. Thank you. Whatever it is.
Was there one song early on where you cracked that emotional moment?
We've had two of them, three of them early on. We had Dinosaurs on the Mountain, which I still think it has a magicness about that let us, you know, go to this nostalgic innocence that's cracked open, but, you know, it's not ruined. It hasn't ruined you. And so that felt like if we could get two or three more that let that be a story. So we had Dinosaurs on the Mountain. We had Mother, I've Taken LSD, which is a sad, sad song. You know, it sounds like it's going to be a hippie song, a party song, but it's not, you know. And we like that. We like that. A lot of people could see it as a title and think, what the fuck is this? But to me, it's a crushing, crushing song. And Stephen and I both would talk about our LSD experiences not being like what Timothy Leary's talking about. You know, they would just be horrible, sad freakiness. And I don't like taking acid. I've only taken it a couple times. So, you know, for me, it was horrible and life-changing. So we had that one, and we had Assassins of Youth, which has, man, there's something about that chugging along that just, man, just a great, great triumphant. We sort of look at Assassins of Youth. Steve and I would talk about it like, you know how ABBA, they're Swedish, but they always sing like an American, you know, they got English words. And I don't think they quite know exactly what it means. You know, the translation doesn't quite do it right. And so sometimes we try to do songs as if we don't really know English that well. And that would be one of them. So this cliched line, Assassins of Youth, you know, we're pretending that we're, you know, we're Swedish or we're Norwegian, and we're not quite sure what you mean by that, but we like what it means, you know? So we're singing it like, you've never heard this before, and it means this thing, but, and so in that way, it's, you know, it's just a thrill that sort of puts yourself in another state of mind, you know? It's like, I don't really know what it means, but it means something when you're singing it, you know? It has, it has something about that, you know, you wish that your youth wasn't ripped from you so quickly. You didn't know it was being ripped from you, but it was, and you can't go back and reclaim it. And there's something about that rollicking, chung, ka-chung, ka-chung, you know. So, yeah. So, but thank you. I'm glad we got to Zoom together. I'll try to do it more often. Yeah.
Cool, man. Always a pleasure.
All right. Well, thanks.
Thanks.
All right.
Have a good one. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Hey, this is Steve Balton. You've been listening to People Have the Power with special guest Wayne Coyne of the Flaming Lips. Thanks.